Scripture this morning will be from Luke chapter 18, verses 2 through 5. Luke 18, 2 through 5. Saying, there was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. Now there was a widow in that city, and she came to him, saying, get justice for me, for my adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me.
Morning. Continuing our study through Luke and the series of Written in Red, we're coming to Luke, the 18th chapter, and we're going to take a look at what is commonly called the persistent widow, persistent being the nice way of saying what we think about the widow, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. If you're the judge, persistent is not the word you use for her. To give you a sense of where we're at in Luke, this is a parable that Jesus very kindly sets the stage for, so we know exactly kind of where he's headed with it. We don't have the time or interest to look at it right now, but in chapter 17, at the end of the chapter, he has been preparing them for not good things to come. That the days, the years, maybe even the decades ahead are going to be rough for his disciples. And this was a tough thing for them to hear, because they're thinking, if they're believing in Jesus as Messiah, that the kingdom is about to just explode on the scene, and the Romans are going to be chased away, and Jesus rules the world, and everything's better. And Jesus is trying to prepare them for a series of events not at all like that, beginning with his own crucifixion and death, and then following with years of hardship for them as disciples, as they tried to take the gospel to the world in the face of a great deal of opposition. So Luke 17:22 says, the days are coming when you will desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. The way I read that is to say, these you will remember as the good old days. They thought the good days were coming. Messiah's here, but good days are coming, and the kingdom's going to do wonderful things. He says, no, these are the good days. The days when Jesus is walking around with you, these are the best days. Days will come when you will wish for those quiet days when angry Pharisees was the worst thing you had to worry about. You're going to wish for these days, but they won't come. Luke 17:25. Speaking of the Messiah, again, trying to change their expectations. Is he going to rule the world and conquer it? Kind of, but not the way you think. Verse 25, he says, but first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. If there was one thing they were absolutely certain about the Messiah, it's that he would not be rejected by his own people. And Jesus says, that's exactly what's going to happen. Well, he's not going to suffer. That's exactly what's going to happen. Take every view that you thought of your coming king and just turn it around, because he says, that's exactly how this is going to play out. And you need to be prepared for that so that you don't lose heart. What happens when you're anticipating something and you build up that anticipation in your mind and it doesn't happen the way you thought it would? You lose heart. That's our expression. Your optimism is just suddenly emptied and bankrupt. You don't have any will to go on. Never mind persevere and be faithful in the face of hardship. I can't go another day because it just didn't play out the way that it was supposed to. So Jesus is trying to prepare them and keep them from losing heart when things go sour. And Luke explains that that's what's going on in our text in Luke 18. If it were up to me, every parable of Jesus would start like this, where the author tells you, and here's what he meant by that, because sometimes I'm not sure. But this time, in case you're not sure, Luke says, here's what it's about in verse 1. And he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. So what do they have? Messiah is not going to come in the way that you think. He's here, but not the way you think he's here. He's going to conquer the world, but not the way you think he's going to conquer the world. He's going to set up his kingdom, but not the way you think he's going to set up the kingdom. Nothing's going to go the way that you think. So what do we do? Well, don't lose heart. Well, that's all well and good. What do we do instead of losing heart? And the answer is to pray, to always be in prayer. If you're coming to our Sunday night services and getting either, of course, we have the evangelism class down the hall, but in the auditorium we're doing a class on prayer, and this kind of connects to that, incidentally. Didn't even plan it. It just kind of connects to that. That this is Jesus telling them that this is the appropriate response to shattered hopes and dreams, to everything going wrong in life. The correct response is prayer, and it's a necessary response. It's the one we have to have. So he tells them this parable on that theme. Now that you know the punchline, you don't have to be surprised by the parable. Here it comes, verses 2 through 3. He introduces us to some people he is less than complimentary of. Verse 2, he said, "In a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor respected man. And there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him and saying, 'Give me justice against my adversary.'" So what do we know about the judge? Nothing good. Think for a moment. What are the two greatest commandments according to Jesus? Love God and love your neighbor. What does this man do? He doesn't fear God and he doesn't respect his neighbor. If loving God and loving your neighbor are the greatest commands, what are the greatest sins? I assume it's not to respect God and not to respect your neighbor, which is who this man is. So if you don't respect God and you don't respect your neighbor, who do you respect? I suspect he thought very highly of himself, but the text doesn't go there. All we really know about him is that he's just a pretty lousy, rotten person. If you get to pick your judge, is this the one you want? Only if you're guilty. If you intend to skate by an injustice, maybe this is the guy. But if you're looking for anything good to happen in this world, this is not the man that you want. This person is the opposite of what any kind of judge should be. This is bad news. He is a rotten person. Does this bother us a little bit? Usually in a parable, a story that Jesus tells, the head figure, the most powerful figure, the judge, the father, the lord, the whoever, the businessman, represents God in some way. We're expecting that. Well, here he kind of does, but also kind of doesn't. He's in the position God's going to find himself in, but he's not at all like God, and that's actually the point of the parable. This guy is just rotten. What do we know about the widow? Again, not a whole lot. There are lots of wonderful feminine characters in the Bible that you can admire. This is not necessarily one of them. We don't know a lot about her. It doesn't say anything particularly negative, but nothing particularly good either. She's a widow. Does a widow have a lot of pull and power in the ancient world? Not so much. Her lot is only slightly improved in our modern society. In the ancient world, she's really on the bottom rung of the ladder of power and access to people of power. She doesn't have a lot of promises she can make. She doesn't have a lot to offer this judge who's clearly looking for some reason to do what she wants. But it's going to have to be a good reason, a self-benefiting reason. And she has nothing to offer. But she keeps coming. Is her cause just? We actually don't know. We have no idea. All we know is that she thinks it is. She wants justice against her adversary. She has some kind of enemy who has wronged her in some way. We don't know if it's real or imaginary. But in her mind, there is an adversary who has wronged her and someone's going to fix it. Is this a lovely lady who's asking for bread? No, not exactly. It doesn't tell us anything bad about her, but this is not a heroine by any stretch. Someone done me wrong and I want you to get them. Give me justice against my adversary. She might be completely vindicated, she might not, but we don't know. She's just asking for this. And what other thing do we know about her is she keeps on coming. She keeps on coming. I'm getting tired of saying this, but it does seem to be true. Luke likes to tell jokes, and he likes to tell stories about Jesus telling jokes. And this is one of those where Jesus is telling a funny story, right? These characters are actually just absurd. The most corrupt judge you can imagine, and then kind of a stereotypical, I'm sorry, ladies, this is not me, this is Jesus, okay? Stereotypical, complaining older woman. I'm so sorry, it's Luke. He has this kind of stereotype in mind that's the response he's looking for. When you hear this story, you all kind of laugh and say, yeah, I know who that is, right? We all kind of get the idea, whether it's true or not, maybe there's never been a woman like this. But we get the story, right? We kind of get the joke. We get the point of what Jesus is doing. There's this really grumpy, rotten man, and here comes this woman, and she just keeps coming. And then in case you weren't sure, the way he tells the rest of the story doubles down on that imagery. I'm not sure what your translations have in verses 4 and 5. I'm going to read the ESV, and then I'm going to feed you what might be a literal Greek translation if you were really to see this for what he's doing with it. Read verse 4 and 5. For a while he refused, but afterward he said to himself, though I neither fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will give her justice so that she will not beat me down by her continual coming. Okay? That's the very pleasant translation in the ESV. The Greek is a little more frightening. The word for bothering me is literally the word for striking or beating. Now, I don't think that's what he meant. I don't think she's punching him. But in his mind, how does he feel when she comes to visit? Here comes this lady, and she just keeps on pounding away on me. It's the word for punching. She just keeps bothering me. She's persistent. Persistent, at least. And then what is the other word? When he says, beat me down, that's actually a pretty good translation. If you have wear me out or tire me, that's almost not strong enough, because the Greek text is the word you'd use for a blackened eye. She comes every day and she pounds away on me. She's blackening my eye. She's wearing me out. Oh yeah, she's beating me up. Kind of a comical image of this widow who comes in and beats up the judge every day, right? And it's not literally what's happening, but that's the words. That's how he feels about her coming. Her continual coming. Again, if you were reading the Greek quite literally, her continually coming to the end of time, right? He's not even sure he's going to outlive this woman. He thinks that forever and ever and ever and ever, every day this lady comes and just pounds away with her complaints and blackens his eye, and he's sick of it. Is he sick of it because he suddenly becomes a good person? Nope. He wants to be very clear, in case you weren't sure, not for any good reason, not because I respect God, not because I respect man, for no good reason, for completely selfish reason, this lady's wearing me out and I'm going to give in. I don't even care if it's right or wrong. He's just tired. Luke Timothy Johnson, in his commentary, says it like this: the parable makes its point so forcefully and humorously that little comment is required. He writes a whole commentary anyway, but never mind that. Contemporary readers can easily imagine an enraged bag lady hitting the negligent magistrate over the head and literally giving him a black eye. We are meant, I think, to laugh. And I tend to agree. It's kind of a goofy story, right? It's not a normal parable, and even the parables are kind of funny sometimes. This one is just this outlandish story that gets you to laugh. Why would he want you to laugh? Because he's got a point that's going to make you cry, and so before we get there, he's going to open you up a little bit and say, isn't this a funny story? Isn't this a silly story? Everybody thinks of their grandmother or somebody else's grandmother or in-laws or something. They think of, you know, the stereotype lady who comes in and they have a laugh at their expense. And Jesus tells this story and everyone giggles. And then he says, now what's the point of this particular story? Take a look at it again. Verses 6 through 8. Jesus says, and the Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says. First of all, he says, listen to that story a moment. In particular, listen to the unrighteous judge and see if you get the point that I'm making. Verse 7, and will not God give justice to his elect who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will give justice to them speedily. What's his point? He says, this is a worst case scenario story. Lousy judge, cranky woman, everything about this is bad. And yet, how does it end up? She gets her way. She gets exactly what she wants just by being, as we like to call it, persistent. Okay? If you're the judge, he never uses the word persistent. He says, she beat me to a pulp every day. But we look at it and say, she was persistent. She had no power. She had nothing to give in this situation to get her way, nothing to leverage with the judge. All she had at her disposal with this wicked, wicked man was that every day she could come back and say it again. And she seems to think that'll work, and sure enough, it does. What's Jesus' point? He says, imagine a very different story. Imagine a judge who is not wicked to the core, but is perfectly righteous. Wouldn't this be a different story? Imagine a widow who's not just wailing on the judge here, but rather night and day is petitioning this God in reverence and fear for what is needed. Shares the persistence, but has the advantage of character and virtue and all the things we just don't know about the widow, whether she has them or not. Wouldn't that story end differently? Wouldn't you expect, let me say it differently, it would actually end exactly the same, only faster. That's what he says in the end of beginning of verse 8. I tell you, he will give justice to them speedily. If you expect this story to end this way, and we kind of did, didn't we? Yeah, it's a rotten judge. But the widow wins every time, doesn't she? I used to work in a library as my very first job. And every person who worked, I was the only man who worked in the entire library system. And these were ladies who had all read this parable and believed that it worked. And let me tell you something, they always won. I never got anything. They got from me whatever they wanted, and they got it every time. Sometimes slowly, because I was a lazy teenage boy, but they got it because they won. We kind of expect it to end this way. But don't we also know that it could be a lot better than this? What if it was a righteous judge who wanted to do the right thing? What if it was a righteous request from a righteous person who night and day isn't beating up on God, but is praying in exactly the way that God would have us to come and speak to Him? Wouldn't that have to be better? What's Jesus' point? This woman with no expectation, no, let me say it differently, no reasonable expectation that she should get her way, has persistence. You, with every expectation that this should work and work well, show no persistence in your prayer life. That's hearing the judge. Now hear the widow, and just kind of look at it from her side of the table for a moment. Why does the widow keep coming? This is a tricky question. I want you to think about it for a minute. We could say mean things about the widow here, but why does she keep coming? Deep down, she believes in the judge. Not that he's a good person. Nobody in their right mind believes he's a good person. She believes that he has the power to fix her problem if only he could be motivated to do it. That make sense? She wouldn't go to this guy every single day if he had no power to fix the problem anyway. That'd be a waste of her time. This is the person who can do something. And so she believes, if I can only motivate him, he'll do the thing that he's supposed to do. Can I give you the modern parallel to this before we get to the punchline of the story? I worked all week thinking, what's the modern parallel to the story of the unrighteous judge? And it came to me finally. A couple of years ago, and this isn't a sad story on my behalf, but this is just the analogy, so go with it. A couple of years ago, as you know, healthcare laws in our country changed. And I was one of those people. Ministers are considered employed by the church in some respects, and in other respects are considered unemployed. Self-employed. And when it comes to insurance, they treat us as self-employed persons. And so I was getting health insurance through a system for self-employed people that, after the changes in the health care law, suddenly kind of poof, went away. And I didn't get to keep the insurance that I liked. And so I got to be the guinea pig. I was one of the first people through the system of the healthcare marketplace. This brand new, exciting bureaucracy created to intimidate and destroy me. It was a system that at its best would have been difficult. And I'm not trying to complain about, this is not a political sermon. At its best, it would have been difficult, but these were new people, and the system was brand new. The first day it was open, it crashed. The people that were there had newly been trained. How do you expect this to go? Forget righteousness. We had questions of competence. I had a conversation, and this was after being on hold for hours at a time. I had a conversation with a lady where I was explaining to her what the website said I was supposed to do, because she didn't know. And at the end of the conversation, when I finally read the line where it said, "You're the person it said to call," she paused, took a deep breath, said a word I will not repeat, and says, "I can't believe it says that." And she's the one that's supposed to help me. Okay? 1 year after that, that program disappeared, and I got to do it all over again to get new insurance the following year. I've done that 3 times. Why do we wait on hold with customer service for an hour, for 2 hours, for 3 hours? And it could be any customer service. It could be, again, the health place, marketplace, or the customer service with AT&T, long distance, or whatever it is. You have all been on hold. Why do you wait? Why don't you hang up 15 minutes in and say, "This is a complete waste of my time"? Sometimes I do. Why do we wait? We wait because we believe on the other end of this maze of bureaucracy and determent is someone. If I could get the right person, they could help do what I need done. Whether it's AT&T or the insurance company or whoever it is, we really, otherwise you wouldn't stay on the line, right? But we believe no matter how many, and I'm sorry if you're in customer service, no matter how many inept, incompetent people we talk to first, if we keep calling in and wait long enough, we'll get the person who can make a difference for us. Does that make sense? We believe that to be true, and so we wait on the line. Now think about that and read the end of verse 8. "Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth?" Why does the parable end that way? Why doesn't it end, "When the Son of Man comes, will we find prayer on earth?" Because his point, while about prayer, is also not about prayer. His point is about faith. His point is that she believed, no matter how the odds were stacked against her, if she just stayed on the line, if she just pestered this judge to death, eventually something good would come of it. Why do we believe more in customer service than we do in God? We'll wait on hold for hours talking to people who don't seem to know what they're talking about because we believe one of them might be able to help us. At the other end of prayer is a person eagerly waiting for every request, who listens to every word, who knows our situation, not in competence, in perfect omniscient knowledge, and has the power to actually make a difference. And we spend minutes speaking to him. Hours and minutes. What's the verdict, folks? We, if we're very honest, have more faith in human customer service than we do with the Almighty. It's a question of faith. We have a fuller expectation that at the end of a phone call with customer service, something good will happen than we do when we spend that time in prayer. Which one do we think is the greater reality? Which one do we think has the greater power? And that's why he tells the joke first. Because if he started off with this, we would have turned our ears off right away. "Don't tell me I believe in people more than I believe in God." He says, "Of course you do. You'd spend all day arguing with people. God doesn't even want to argue with you. He just wants to listen." And we'll spend minutes at best. We have to force ourselves to spend minutes at best speaking to God. It's because we really deep down, in that honest look in the mirror moment, don't actually believe he's going to do anything about it. In absolute honesty, we think we'd have better luck with customer service than the Almighty. And Jesus says, that's the problem. So he asked the question, "When the Son of Man comes, will he find any faith at all?" Will he find any people who believe in their God enough to still be praying when the Son of Man comes? I don't know what the disciples thought about that. I know 2,000 years later, that's even tougher a parable to hear. A lot of years have passed. A lot of people have prayed. And maybe it gets a little easier every day to lose our persistence in prayers. What keeps us persistent? It is the faith that God has more power to change the world than any person we could talk to here, than any action we could commit here. That the most powerful thing we do is prayer. That not the last resort, but the first endeavor of any enterprise ought to be with our God in prayer. That's the most, that's the best, and not the least. The difference in those two views, Jesus says, is actually a question of faith. So the rebuke this morning, I don't know if prayerlessness is a word or prayerless, but we're going to say it is. The rebuke is to the prayerless. And what Jesus is saying is actually very harsh. He's not saying, for those of you who don't pray what you should, you are ignoring a convenient but pleasant Christian habit that you might ought to develop. He's not saying, if you're not praying, it's kind of like bad table manners and maybe you ought to straighten that up sometime. He's not saying, here is a luxury you might make some time for someday. What he's saying is to be prayerless is to be faithless. That there is no prayerless person of faith. Only prayerless, faithless people. And I'm glad he told the joke first. Because that hurts. Because that's been me more often than it hasn't. And it's been every one of us. If today you had to convince the Almighty God that you were faithful, and all he had in front of him was your life in prayer, would he be convinced of anything? Would anyone? Our faith can't be just something that floats around in our head. It has to motivate us to behave in a certain way, and prayer is that behavior. It's a reason that we pray in our assemblies. It's a reason that at the end of sermons we extend an opportunity to pray. It's not a convenience. It's not something we do just for custom, though it is a custom. It's because we think the best thing we could do for any person here would be to pray for them. And that would matter. It's why we invite people to put on Christ in baptism and to have, as we studied in Hebrews in class this morning, a high priest who intercedes for us and brings us even closer to the righteous judge in prayer. If only we would have the faith to approach Him so. If you're doing neither of these things, don't walk out of today's assembly of worship and say to yourself, I'm just a faithful person who doesn't pray. Listen to what Jesus actually says about us and know who you are. I don't like it, but Jesus didn't ask me to. If there's any way we can help you today to respond to the gospel in obedience or in prayer, the invitation stands open as we stand and sing.